Greetings, my friends. This is Mark Foster coming to you from the Newport Beach office of UBS with another episode of Newport Legacy Insights. Today, it is April 30th, April 10th, earlier in the month. I just had my birthday. Finally hit the big 70, and time to start collecting Social Security. Life is good, I guess. It is a beautiful day here in California. In fact, many of these days tend to feel exactly the same. You kind of lose track of time when you're living here. That is until the things that really matter to you kind of remind you the passage of time. You know, for example, watching how quickly the grandchildren grow up and how quickly they learn new skills like T-ball to coach pitch to kid pitch. So, you know, I see how quick things change for them, and it reminds me that things are changing quick for me too, I guess. Oh, well. Anyway, today, I'm excited to be joined by my friend and colleague, David Lefkowitz. He is the head of equity research for global wealth management at UBS. And most of you who are regular listeners to the podcast or used to listen to the conference calls, you probably know David or remember David. He's been with me many times, and he is, you know, incredible thoughtful insights and helpful throughout the years. So I really appreciate him. He's not on the call yet. In our conversation today, I'm going to be asking David a series of questions about what he feels like, or what I see, is a kind of a growing disconnect between a strong U.S. economy, equity markets pretty much at all-time highs, and a population that seems pretty dissatisfied. We'll also spend time talking about what's happening in the world of artificial intelligence, both from an investment standpoint and from a broader societal perspective. Before bringing David into the conversation, though, I want to step back for a moment and visit a historical period of significance where there was economic change. And, you know, basically, there's this economist or an economic historian. The guy's name is Robert C. Allen. And in 2009, he wrote a research paper. And in this research paper, he came up with the phrase Engel's pause. So what Robert Allen was drawing an observation on is the work that Friedrich Engels did in the 1840s, following the invention of the steam engine in England. In essence, you know, this helped England transition from an agrarian economy to an industrial one. It was the original Industrial Revolution. And this shift took place basically between 1790 and 1840. During that period, England experienced a sharp rise in per capita output, pretty much driven dramatically by productivity gains, in essence, you know, replacing horses with steam engines. However, the real wages for the working class pretty much remained largely flat. In essence, when you replace people with machines, unemployment hypothetically goes up, so you have excess supply of labor. So wages generally did keep up with inflation. However, the economic benefits of higher productivity flowed predominantly to the owners of capital through rising profits and rising dividends. So basically, it's kind of the K economy that we're seeing today to a certain extent, where different groups are benefiting and others are not necessarily participating quite as much. For those of you who are not historians, Friedrich Engels happens to be the guy that co-authored the Communist Manifesto with his buddy Karl Marx. They argued that industrialization functioned as a mechanism for transferring wealth from labor to capital. Sounds familiar, right? Well, Engels is often remembered for his political ideology. Analysis suggests his observations about labor class economic stagnation during this whole period was pretty much accurate. So the reason this history matters today is the question of whether, you know, we're going to see a similar dynamic emerged from the productivity gains created by artificial intelligence, which they're referring to now as the fourth industrial revolution. The concern is that companies may become far more productive and far more profitable while needing fewer workers, potentially leaving segments of the workforce behind. So in today's environment, that risk may apply more to college-educated white-collar workers than to blue-collar workers. And we can, you know, definitely see these kind of concerns starting to show up in some of our various elections. But to be clear, this represents pretty much a smaller share of the overall workforce than it did in the late 1800s or early 1900s, 19th century, when nearly 90% of workers were agrarian. And this process took 50 years to make this transition. But still, today, this process, the implications could be economically and socially significant. So with that historical perspective as context, I'm pleased to bring in David Lefkowitz into this conversation to talk about the economy, about the markets, about the effects of AI and whatever tends to come up. So I am going to connect this call and thank David once again for sharing all of his valuable insights. So David, really appreciate you being here. And as you weren't on the call, the first part of the call, but basically what I talked about was kind of the ultimate K economy, the first industrial revolution from 1790 to 1840, when Friedrich Engels talked about the Engels pause. Actually, it was Allen, the economist Allen, talking about Engels pause. And that kind of plays into a question I hope to ask you a little later in the call about AI and the labor markets. But to begin with, things just feel kind of crazy. UBS Research always suggests to look for the signal amongst the noise. And right at the moment, with the conflict in the Middle East, with all this political vitriol, with the affordability concerns, and the incredibly low approval ratings on the economy, at least from the standpoint of presidential approval ratings, it's hard to believe that the markets are hitting all-time highs. And you've recently put out some pieces talking about profit growth and how things are actually looking surprisingly good. So what's really going on with the economy, and why do you think people feel so disconnected?
Yeah, it's a great question, Mark. And before we get into it, just thanks for having me again. It's always great chatting with you. You always ask very on point and pointed questions. So happy to have this conversation. So I think big picture, I think we really have to separate how we feel from what we do. Because quite frankly, as a country, we haven't really felt great for a long time. You know, you can look at these surveys, right? Surveys of like, is the country on the right track or the wrong track? That's usually how they formulate them. And believe it or not, I mean, since the financial crisis, actually really since almost the dot-com bust, I mean, you know, pretty large majorities of the country, not all the time, but pretty consistently have said that we're on the wrong track. Like 60% is the average. 60% of the population thinks we're on the wrong track. So this has been going on for like two decades. And so, and yet obviously over that period, we've seen a tremendous growth in the economy, tremendous growth in wealth. And so I just think it's a reflection of this, there is a dichotomy, or at least, you know, people don't feel great, but it doesn't really impact how consumers and businesses are making decisions, right? I mean, even though you pointed out all the crazy stuff going on in the world, I mean, people are still taking vacations. Well, maybe they're scaling back vacations a little bit because airline fares are so high. In general, people are still living their lives, raising families, having, you know, when your family expands, you need to buy a new house, although that's harder to do these days too because of affordability, as you point out. But the point I'm trying to make is that I don't know if the headlines that people see in the on the news and in their social media feeds, they don't seem to have an outsized impact on behavior. So people, consumers, my rule of thumb is consumers will spend when they have jobs. And consumers have jobs. Unemployment rate's low. And so that's why the spending has been pretty good. And then, you know, on the business side, businesses will invest where they see opportunities. So, and then, so I would also say the North Star for the stock market is not the political polls. It's not what's happening in Washington. It's really what's happening with profits. Because as when we, if we went back to our finance 101 classes, the value of any company is the discounted value of its future cash flows, or the net present value of its future cash flows. And profits, as you mentioned, are really coming in quite strong. So that's really the bottom line. I think people, when they tell pollsters how they feel, they say one thing. And then when they actually live their lives, they do something a little bit different. And it's been that way for quite a while now.
I think you're right or onto something. I think, you know, the great financial crisis, or whatever you call it, in 08, 09, I mean, everybody was just fat, dumb, and happy ripping along in 2006 into 2007. And that one, I mean, you really felt like the system could fail. And that was, it took a long time to come out of that. So that really was an interesting point where our confidence was pretty much crushed. That's for sure. This year, how much, you must have a guesstimate on how much you think corporate earnings are going to rise. What are you forecasting?
Our published numbers are too low.
Right? Oh, really?
So we're out there in print saying they'll be up 11% this year. But based on the first quarter numbers and some of the trends that we were seeing even before the first quarter numbers came in, yeah, I think there's definitely upside risk or upside to those numbers. So in the first quarter, they're going to come in at 17. We had estimated 17%. It's probably even going to be a little bit better than that. So this is like really strong. Usually corporate profits grow, Mark, you know, usually it's like 8 to 10 when, you know, when the economy is not in a recession, obviously, that's sort of the average. So yeah, they're really strong. A lot of it's because of AI and stuff like that.
I guess the question is, some of that potentially will disappear. I mean, for example, oil prices are really high. Will some of these oil companies just have stupid high profits? You've got shortage of chips. Will some of these chip companies just have stupid high profits? And then if you go out a year, all of a sudden that kind of evaporates. Do we run that kind of a risk?
Yeah, it's a great point. Because if we look at, so you totally nailed it. If you look at the average company or the median company, I like to look at just to give me a better sense for how, you know, if there are certain companies distorting the numbers, and the median company will probably grow this year more like that normal 9 to 10%.
Yeah.
Yeah. It might be more like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, call it 8 to 9, maybe 10. So that's a more normal number. But yeah, exactly. Again, you really hit it on the head because it's the semis that are really seeing truly mind-boggling rates of growth. And obviously the energy companies as well, they're a little bit smaller portion. And for semis, it's really been predominantly pricing. There's such a, we just don't have the ability to satisfy the demand that's out there based on these AI data centers. And so we're shipping more chips, but they're in such high demand, the pricing is literally through the roof. And it's basically a profits gusher for some of these semi companies. And you're right, though, when supply and demand are better balanced, then we know what happens. The pricing is going to go back down and go back down dramatically. We don't think that's a risk for this year.
No, but 27.
But it does
do you all of a sudden say, well, earnings may grow 5% because their earnings, that those two sectors are going to actually pull back? Even if they, you know, like you say, they're going to be shipping more product, but as more product becomes available, the prices are going to become softer. So,
yeah, it's definitely a risk. I mean, the other thing, though, is I think we just heard from a lot of the data center companies last night, the big ones, the hyperscalers, as we call them, and their capital spending numbers are all going up for next year, too. Right. So the demand, it just looks like the demand is, it's been consistent. The consistent story with this AI infrastructure build out has been, it's stronger and longer than we've thought, you know, right from the get go. And I think it's shaping up for same thing's going to happen now as we look into 27.
What's interesting is you look at sectors that were not considered growth industries before, like the industrials, and all of a sudden their PE ratios are rating higher and higher, and they just look more and more expensive. But the more CapEx that's out there, the more justified it seems. But it gets scary buying something that traditionally is, you know, a cyclical, not a grower, and paying up for it. And I guess the whole market, I mean, PE ratios are likely to come down if we actually hit our target. And I think you emailed to me that your target is 7,500. So if earnings come in at that, you know, let's say hypothetically, if they were 17% for the whole year, that's not a 17% rate of return on the S&P. It's more like a 10%. So PE ratios in general are coming down a little bit because I guess the investment community figures that it's not repeatable or it can't be sustained at that higher rate of growth. Is I don't know if I even had a question in there or not, but
I think it's the right way to think about it. Is I think the valuation changes are usually a reflection of the market's confidence in the outlook or lack thereof. Right. So usually when PE multiples are expanding, it means the market is getting more confident about the durability or sustainability or the size of the profit pool down the road. And then conversely, multiples will compress when the opposite happens. So, yeah, it comes down to, I think, I guess said another way, there could be upside to our price what the market does this year.
Sure.
Yeah, there could be. I mean, but, you know, I think it's a little bit early. We do need to start doing more work on 27 to start getting, you know, more confidence about that. But as we sit here today, I think 27 is shaping up, you know, it seems pretty far away at this point, but the market's going to start focusing on it, certainly right after the summer, which is not too far away from where we are right now. Yeah. I mean, if the market has confidence that expansion continues into 27, AI spending continues robust, the ROI on that is all looking like it's moving in the right direction, then I think that's the scenario where, yeah, you do see better returns than we're penciling in.
Yeah. You mentioned early on, you know, if the consumer has jobs, and this morning they came out with the jobs numbers and they were, or well, the layoff numbers, I guess, unemployment data. And the number was surprisingly low. And the commentator was talking about how it's these numbers are numbers we haven't seen since about the late 1960s or so. And we hear a lot about, how's the consumer faring, especially when the banks come out with their earnings and they talk about, you know, borrowing and how the consumer's doing. And then you also hear that, oh my gosh, the big risk to the economy is going to be oil prices, and oil prices will get to the point where it's going to crush the consumer, and that is going to create a recession. I mean, is there any risk or any realistic risk to that, or is that just some talking point? And let me add to this, again, one of these non-questions, I guess. The other interesting thing that came out today is that the GDP went up by 2%, and you could attribute 1.5% of that to the data center and AI connected growth. So back to the oil risk question. If there's so much growth coming from the industrial economy, how significant is the consumer right at the moment? Is it less significant than normal? And do these oil prices matter?
Okay. A lot to unpack there. I would say, let's hit on the GDP numbers first. Okay. I would say, yes, GDP came in at 2%. But if you look at consumer spending is 2/3 of economic activity. If you look at personal consumption spending, so consumer spending, that was up 1.6%. So it was okay, and maybe a little bit on the lower side. But yeah, to me, that's always certainly usually the biggest driver of economic growth, just because it is the biggest component of economic activity. So it was fine. I mean, it wasn't blockbuster. But maybe it's a little bit slightly on the softer side. Actually, if I look at the estimates, I'd have to dig into this a little bit more, Mark, but actually it came in a little bit even stronger than what people were estimating. It's possible, you know, don't forget we had those storms I don't know if you did, but I certainly did in New York.
We had
some pretty bad winter weather and stuff like that. So that could have been dampening some spending numbers. But I would say, look, you know, we're in the middle of earnings season. The overarching message we are getting from consumer-oriented companies is that they are not seeing any slowdown because of higher oil prices or any of the other stuff that we mentioned, that that's somewhat distracting. And in fact, a number of companies talked about even some acceleration. So I think, you know, so what explains all this? I think there's a few things here, right? I think, first of all, the U.S., with respect to the oil shock, first of all, we are a net energy exporter. So now, obviously, consumers feel the pain, producers get the gain, but it all does stay in the U.S. economy now because we're not sending these dollars overseas. Second, and probably this is probably the more important point, is that there was a pretty big fiscal stimulus. The tax cuts that were part of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, those didn't really, people didn't start to get those benefits until they filed their taxes for the April 15th deadline. And so refunds were bigger than normal. And also withholding tables were finally adjusted at the first of the year. So these numbers are actually pretty big. It's roughly $100 billion of additional money into consumers' pockets. So that, I think, is definitely offsetting some of the oil impact. But it's also important to bear in mind, I mean, energy spending is only about 3.5% of consumer budgets. So it's not big. Obviously, lower income consumers, it's more. It's maybe 7 or 8%. So it matters more. But it's really not that big in the scheme of things. And so I think the short answer is...
It doesn't matter.
Yeah. I mean, I think it kind of matters.
Look, so,
I think it matters. Yeah. I mean, if we do see... Look, I mean, there is a level at which I think we would see some negative impact and sort of a duration also, right? There's a level at which oil prices and gasoline prices go to that you will see a little bit more of an impact. And if it stays there longer, for a longer period of time, then it starts to accumulate in terms of the headwind. So we've been, right now, the national average gasoline price is around, I think today is like 430, which is up a lot. It was around 3 before the war. If it gets to 5 and stays there, or let's say above 5 and stays there, I do think you would start to see some slow down in terms of consumer spending at that point. I don't think it'd be a recession, but I do think you would see the markets get a little bit more concerned about that.
Yeah. Changing gears, your colleague, Ulrike Bucardi, and I didn't pronounce her last name. How do you pronounce her last name? Bucardi?
Yeah, it's Hoffman Bucardi.
There you go. Well, she put out a piece 2 days ago, and basically it spoke to these gigantic IPOs that may come out in the second half of this year, companies like SpaceX, for example. And her conjecture seemed to be that the money to go into these stocks are going to have to come out of existing stocks on the market. And she pointed to the fact that the Mag 7 companies make up something like 30% of the S&P 500, and that was probably going to be the area where there's selling pressure. I guess that makes sense. But she made a comment that I didn't understand, and maybe you can clarify. She said that we should be selling soft assets to purchase physical assets. And I didn't understand what she meant by that distinction. What's considered a soft asset? What's considered a physical asset? And what is she telling us to do?
Yeah, sure. So I would say, I think there's two impacts that I think we're going to see in the marketplace as a result of these mega IPOs. I think the first one that you alluded to is what I would call the liquidity impact, and there's a competition impact. Let me explain what I mean by that. Liquidity, that's what you were referring to, Mark, where investors are going to have to
pull the money from somewhere
in their portfolios. Yeah, exactly. And I think, look, I think that could be a short-term headwind. I think it'd be very modest. Maybe we don't even see it. But yeah, money will move around, and these are large sums of money that we're talking about. So, you know, there could be some of that impacting some of these existing stocks. I think the bigger question is really more on the competition, because many of these startups, I guess you call them startups, but they're gigantic at this point. They're really attacking, they have to make money, first of all, obviously, right? And so they're really starting, where they're attacking is existing profit pools like software and advertising. Because, for instance, look at Claude Code is helping people code software. That's Anthropic's product. And OpenAI has the same thing. And also OpenAI has introduced advertising in their ChatGPT service, right? So they're going after digital advertising, and they're going after software. And so what Ulrika's saying is like, look, these markets are going to face more and are starting to face more competition. And even some of the Magnificent Seven themselves, some of these large tech companies that are already public and out there, everybody knows, they're also starting to get into each other's businesses more so. And so the point we're trying to make here is that with these new tools and the way the competitive landscape is today, it's a lot more competitive than it was, say, 10, even 5 years ago, when all these mega cap companies were sort of in their own lane. You had, you know, Google focused on search, Meta focused on social, Microsoft focused on enterprise, Amazon focused on e-commerce. Now they're all encroaching on each other's territory in some sense, and they're trying to fend off these startups. So the only thing what we're trying to say here is, look, these have been great businesses, but the uncertainty has increased because the competition has gotten a lot more intense. And it's going to be hard to know who the winners and losers are going to be as we go through this AI transition. And that's why she's saying focus on physical companies that are more, you know, selling products and services that are more in the physical layer, so to speak, because they can't really as easily be disrupted by AI. That's
so
really,
in essence,
I think, the best way to think about it.
Almost like the industrials. If you make a big yellow device that moves dirt around, or a big green device that corn stalks around, that's not a business that's really going to get threatened at all. So there's more security in an industrial type of business than a business where they're all trying to cannibalize each other.
Yes, exactly. But I also, there's other things. It's not just even industrial. I mean, you know, semiconductors are physical, right?
Yeah,
I mean, and so that's also, it's just, I would say, put it through a different lens. I mean, we like to look at, and Warren Buffett has sort of popularized this, right? What's the moat that the company has around it? You know, thinking of a castle with a moat around it, what protections does the business have from competition? And the point here is that with AI and the amount of capital that is being invested and the size of these companies and their ambitions, a lot of the moats around these digital companies are looking a little bit like there's not enough water in them.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's going to be easier to traverse and attack. Whereas you don't have, you know, so our point is like, yeah, there might be winners. There's going to be winners and losers. We just think it's going to be really hard to know at this stage. Whereas you can buy other companies whose moats are not under attack and you don't have to worry about it.
Right. You know, right now, the market feels a little reminiscent of the late 1990s. The market's not up like 30% like it may have been back in, you know, 99 or something. But there are definitely stocks that are up 30% or have, you know, doubled, or say. You have suggested to me that human nature being what it is that eventually we're just going to drive right off the cliff. So I guess the question is, where's the cliff? Are we approaching the cliff, or do we have a long runway? I mean, is there any way for anyone to even know?
I would say the short answer is it's hard to know, but I think there are some clues. And look, I do think, Mark, I do think it's just sort of human nature that people latch onto a trend and we tend to just take it too far. You know, it's just a little bit human nature, and things sort of gather their own momentum in some sense. And what I mean, you know, just to make this more tangible, like, where's all the investment going? It's all going into data centers. I think it's fairly likely that we will over invest and overbuild data centers. But as you point out, the $64 billion question is, when is that going to happen? And I'm not too worried about that right now. I think, you know, when you look at past cycles, and like you and I have been in this business for a few decades at least at this point, right?
Yep.
And I was a telecom analyst in the late 90s, and I really had a front row seat to the dot-com situation and then ultimately the bust. And so I really studied this to really make sure I understood what were the lessons, what do we really need to pay attention to? Because these investment booms and busts, I mean, you can look through history, they happen fairly regularly. some of them, you know, are in little pockets of the economy. Some of them are in big pockets of the economy and have bigger implications. I think this is a big one. And when they tend to end, it's oftentimes when the Fed is hiking interest rates, because a lot of these investment booms depend on, they need to raise capital, right? They need to raise money to fund the build out of whatever it is that is popular at that time. You know, in the late 90s, it was long distance telecom networks and networking gear and dot-coms that didn't make any money. Or even more recently, you know, housing bubble, right? It was people were buying homes with mortgages they couldn't afford. And in both of those cases, the end was really because the Fed was tightening the screws. And so that to me, so if we did get into that situation where the Fed was hiking interest rates because they were worried about inflation, and to some extent, this also happened in 22 with the inflation problem we had, that would be a very different backdrop in my mind. And I think the risk would be a lot higher then. But, you know, the good news is I don't think we'll need to be hiking anytime soon.
Yeah.
Or at least.
Right.
I mean,
hopefully the AI becomes deflationary. I mean, some people have suggested it'll reduce inflation. We'll see. But, you know, I have a different thought on inflation, and maybe maybe wrong, but it seems like if more countries seem to be concerned about what we experienced during the pandemic and the lack of access to certain things, so they want to do some reshoring. So if we really get serious on the reshoring front, it seems like that would put a little pressure on inflation, and that could ultimately be a little problematic. But we'll leave that for another discussion. Okay. Maybe my last question is, you know, when I started the call today, I made reference to the K-shaped economy and talked about the original industrial revolution. And they refer to AI, I guess, as the fourth industrial revolution. And we're seeing now at these big tech companies layoffs of gigantic numbers. And why are these people laying off significant numbers of employees? Is it because AI actually works and they're becoming productive? Is it that they just hired too many darn people during the whole pandemic era? Or have they made such big CapEx commitments that now they have to cut costs because they recognize there's an issue there?
Yeah, I think if I had to give you a very short answer, I would say it's probably mostly motivated by the last piece you mentioned. They're spending so much money on building these data centers, they need to offset that with cost savings elsewhere. In addition, a lot of these companies are at the center of where the productivity gains are being seen, which is in software development. But I think it's more the latter than the former, but probably a little bit of both. And so that's why you're seeing it in some of these big tech companies, but we're really not seeing it anywhere else. I mean, you yourself just pointed out, Mark, that, you know, how the unemployment claims are
really low.
They're so low. You talked about since like the 1960s. I mean, and think about how much larger the labor force is now, right? It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy how low these numbers are.
Yeah.
I mean, so we're definitely not seeing it in the data. It's much more anecdotal at this point. And I do think it is highly motivated by these large companies that are investing so much money, I mean, mind-bogglingly large sums of money, and they all raised their numbers in terms of spending last night, they need to make space, so to speak, and find some savings elsewhere. I think that's a big factor. So I'm not too worried about that as we sit here today.
So the average white-collar guy shouldn't feel threatened by some computer taking away his job.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't want to sound blasé about it. I think with any new technology, there will be job losses and creative destruction will do its thing, right? So there will be things that are created and there will be some things destroyed. And I do think it's probably very important for workers to learn how to use these tools to ensure that they do stay productive. But I think on a net basis, so let's put it this way, we've never seen any new technology in the hundreds of years of human history, we've never seen any new technology that has driven any meaningful increase in the unemployment rate. It's just never happened. So I think that's a pretty solid historical record to stand on. And I think what we're going to see, but that doesn't mean there won't be some jobs at risk, but new jobs will be created. And I think what people miss is that just because something got cheaper to do, like let's just say, I'm going to use Coke as an example, because Coke actually talked about this, right? They're using AI to, they're a big marketer. They spend a lot on advertising. They're big fans of using AI tools in developing their content, their advertising content. And they're like, we're saving all this money, right? But what are they doing? They're not laying people off. What they're doing instead is they are producing more of it. And so instead of producing a commercial that maybe would air across the country, they can produce different versions of that commercial for a lot cheaper, and they can have a more targeted advertisement specific to a specific part of the country.
So it becomes more effective, in essence. Same cost, more effective.
Exactly. So I think that's the other thing that people tend to not spend too much time on is that, and this is also true, like when things get cheaper, we tend to spend more.
We
don't necessarily cut our spending. We just use them more. Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, I have a whole bunch more questions, but I think we've kind of taken all the time we should take today. So I'll have to get you back on and ask you some of these other questions that I have another time. I really appreciate all the access you give me. You're so responsive. You pick up the phone every time I get nervous about something, calm me down when I'm nervous, and you pull me back when I'm overly optimistic. And you're a great governor, keeping me on the straight and narrow and helping all of the investors that are listening to this call. So I really thank you for your time today, and thank you for your friendship. You mean a lot to me.
Yeah, likewise, Mark. Happy to do it and really enjoy talking with you and your clients. And yeah, more than happy to do it anytime.
Thank you so much, David. And this concludes another episode of Newport Legacy Insights. Thank you very much, everybody. I appreciate your participation. Bye-bye for now.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC registered broker dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.
This podcast was edited by Resonate Recordings.